Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Really appreciate your attendance at our panel, Best Practices for Doing Business in Emerging Markets. My name is Gary Pavlik. I'm with Nair & Co. We're a silver level sponsor. Have any questions about setting up to do business in most any foreign country, please stop by our booth. We'll help you out. As you see, we have a couple changes on the panel. We have Bob Nephew from Korn Ferry and Venu Raghavan, the President and CEO of Ancora. On our panel, we have over 100 years of experience for you on doing business in emerging markets and in the first world. We've got a combination of Harvard MBAs, Thai charter members, and or Oxford PhDs. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce Mintu Bhandari. He's the managing partner of the View Group. Sir.
I have the easy job today, so I get to just introduce these gentlemen who know a lot about doing business in emerging markets. quickly, their backgrounds. Bob Nephew has more than 25 years' experience in executive recruiting. He is a senior client partner at Korn Ferry, which is the largest global high-level executive recruitment firm. He specializes in the recruitment of senior executives in technology, professional services, and venture capital. And he is a Thai charter member. Next to him is Dr. Sean Nair. Dr. Nair runs a 200-person service organization of accountants and lawyers located throughout the UK, US, India, China, and is currently supporting over 150 venture-backed and public tech companies in 42 countries. He's an Oxford PhD in nuclear physics, and he is also a Thai charter member. Next to him is Dave View. Dave is the CEO of a company named A123 Systems. He joined A123 within 3 months of the company's initial financing and after its naming, which we'll ask you about as well. And he brings more than 30 years of experience in high-tech businesses. He's held high-level corporate officer positions at APC, American Power Corporation, and served as the VP of Marketing and Worldwide Business Development, and helped to grow that company from $50 million to $1.5 billion, and making it the largest world leader in power protection for the PC and information systems markets with 6,000 employees. And finally, but certainly not least, Venu Raghavan is the president and CEO of Ancora. Ancora is a company that's pioneering some interesting models in software development. Venu has a long track record in software development. He was the managing director of Ness Global Services, which is a NASDAQ-listed IT services company. He was also VP of Serenova, another NASDAQ-listed company. And he's held leadership roles in sales and marketing at IntelliGroup, Max Avnet, Motorola, and IED Perry, one of the leading companies in South India. We put this panel together with the express purpose of having a balanced and deep perspective on some of the most crucial areas of operating in emerging markets: HR and executive recruitment, regulatory compliance, tax strategy, sourcing and international partnership development, and outsourcing of software development. So with that, why don't we get into the topics that each of these folks represent in depth. The format that we wanted to follow was essentially to give you high-level points that we would like to emphasize and have each of the speakers discuss in some depth each of their areas of expertise and their observations. And then I will ask some questions, then we will open it up to questions for the audience. With that, I'll hand it over to Bob to talk about executive recruitment.
Thank you, Mintu. I'm Bob Nephew from Korn Ferry here in the Boston office, and I lead the technology practice. Some of the information I'll be sharing with you today, most of it really comes from our clients who are based in the Boston area and who have opened operations in Malaysia, Singapore, China, and then some of the emerging companies in countries in Europe. So, and then of course, my partners in Beijing and Singapore and India who have shared their thoughts as well. So in terms of information on the human resources or the organizational dynamic involved in getting an operation off the ground, what I heard time and time again is that culture sort of reigns supreme. And within the culture, there's an element of trust. And I say culture now. I'm speaking particularly about a client of mine who, in the last 18 months, has grown an organization from zero to 2,500 people in China. And what he's observed, this is the second time he's done it, and what he's observed is that trust is the primary ingredient to growing an organization. So as he's hired the executives to run his organization in China, and they've gone on to build the organization, the trust demonstrates itself first in family members, then in friends of family, and then in friends and in friends of family, so that there's a high degree of connectedness that is around the family and that people consider crucial to building a business over there. And that relates to the hiring process and trying to manage the hiring process. It relates to the quality of people that you can bring on board, and it also relates to the competence you can expect from the organization. When those things aren't necessarily the primary criteria, so often you'll find an organization hiring someone who they know very well, or an executive hiring someone who they know very well and they know they can trust, who don't have the background and skills, and there is no job description. There's not a reference check involved. There's a presumption that I know this person, I trust them, I can train them. The impact on efficiency is that'll take some time, so that expectations to achieve the same levels of efficiency and the same time frames towards efficiency or organizational competence are elongated. Another element that has come up time and time again is if you're going to generate the kind of organizational competence that would endure over a period of time in an organization, one of the things you need to do is invest and make it known that you're going to invest in the people that you hire. So you may bring in an executive from from the U.S. or the parent nation, but quickly you've got to surround that person with local individuals and expertise, and you've got to invest in those individuals through training, trips back to the United States, educational opportunities, potentially cross pollination of executives, so bringing them back to the United States for tours of duty and then returning them back to their home country, so that there's a sense of belonging and long-term investment, which translates into not only competence and organizational capability, but it translates into loyalty and longevity of your organization. So I would say the cultural impact is not something to be underestimated in terms of the selection of people and organizational executives, and then the investment, the real investment in development of those people are major factors. We have noticed some trends, and the one of the trends has a genesis in what's happened around the world and here in the United States. We're probably going to talk a little bit about that, the impact of that trend a little later. And then there's a major cultural trend that is sort of relates to Ray's conversation this morning in terms of an exponential assumption of responsibility by total cultures. that companies used to have. And we'll get back to that as you begin to ask some questions. Thank you.
Super. Thanks very much. Sean?
Hello, everybody. Good afternoon. My name is Shankaran Nair, and I hope you can hear me. I think the mic is now on. Basically, I know a little bit about a lot of the aspects of setting up operations in foreign countries, both in the emerging markets as well as in the established markets. It's important when you're starting up operations afresh in a new country, particularly in an emerging market, to clearly strike the right balance between cost and risk. On the one hand, you don't want to over-engineer your tax structure and your setup costs in relation to the cost of the employees you're going to hire and the sales you're going to achieve in the short term, while equally, you don't want to do things so cheap that you now end up with tax and potential employment-related exposures that come and sting you on your backside 1 year later. So what do I mean by that? A few illustrative examples. Let's take China first. If you're setting up in China, the cheapest and quickest way of doing it is to set up a representation office if you're hiring your first couple of employees. But there are a couple of drawbacks of a representation office. For example, it may be difficult for you if you have a fraud or a theft of IP to be able to sue the offending party in a Chinese court if you're set up as a rep office, although you can be sued on any other matter by a Chinese party. Also, if you're a U.S. entity that's doing this, that's doing the hire, there are difficulties, significant difficulties, in getting employees of rep offices over to the U.S. and getting visas to get them over. So while setting up a rep office is the cheapest way, and it may be a completely valid way to do it in a particular set of circumstances, it's important that it's done laterally thinking across all of the issues with your eyes open. Secondly, let's now take the stage where you've now set up, operation is a success, you're getting sales, or your R&D is working out, whatever it is. Now, it's very important that you review your type of setup there in relation to the success of your activities and take steps to beef up your infrastructure. I'm sure that everybody on this panel will agree that nobody wants to pay accountants and attorneys. They want to spend money on developing technology and selling product, and that's absolutely valid. But it is important that you look at the success. You know, if you've sold several million dollars worth of goods, to spend a small amount of that money in beefing up your setup to reflect the success of the operation. So what do I mean by that? Let's take India as an example. You might initially just set up as a liaison office, which is the Indian equivalent of the Chinese representation office. But your operation now succeeds, you want to set up a subsidiary. It's important before you set up a subsidiary to look at all your potential tax breaks. If you're a software company, you might want to set up your subsidiary in one of the software technology parks of India, where there are tax breaks available at least up to the year 2009, and they're planning to extend it. Or if you have a much stronger commitment to the Indian market, you might want to set up a subsidiary within a special economic zone. China also has similar economic zones where there are tax breaks available and tax holidays available. So you should look at all that before you beef up the infrastructure. But you should always be looking at your existing infrastructure against the existing success and activities being carried out. Last but not least, the exposures could arise from employment. The emerging markets, to my way of thinking, at the present time, are China, India, Russia, and Brazil. Let's take Brazil as an example. Brazil has draconian employment laws, much worse than anything in Europe, driven by union-related rules, unionization, more or less compulsory-type rules. And it's very important, if you hire in Brazil, that you should reserve for yourself all the rights that you can have as an employer, which you would lose if you did not reserve them. So you should not be sending out U.S.-style offer letters saying you're employed at will, when you're hiring in Brazil, because in Brazil, the concept of employment at will doesn't exist. And by doing that, you've lost rights like the right to put them on probation, the right to pay in lieu of notice, things like that. So really, I'm a kind of, I know a little bit about a lot, different countries, and it's really the important thing is to be aware of the exposures and the hidden potholes into which you can fall, to get appropriate advice, to ensure that you navigate around them rather than that you fall into them.
Thank you. Thank you. Dave, tell us about A123 and sourcing.
Sure. We have contact here? That's great. I'm David View, president of A123 Systems, and I'm going to talk a little bit about sourcing, but maybe relationship building and building a network of partners on a global basis in the emerging market space. My first serious foray into the emerging markets of China, India, and Brazil was about 11 years ago. I was working for American Power Conversion, and what my first feeling was about the activity was it was a little bit more like the Wild West, and I actually loved it because the experience is a space with less rules and less structure, and not the sense of the game over that we often see in the markets that we have here today. The winners have not been declared on the market side or on the manufacturing side. And so that feeling of opportunity that permeates the country is something that you experience when you go there, and it kind of you can catch fire with it. It's a great feeling. But when you try to set up a relationship or a business, and in this particular case, I'm talking maybe a little less so about a simple procurement, but I'm talking about a business relationship that might involve a technology transfer or some significant transfer of information and the development of a long-term business relationship with someone local in that area. What I found out is that the people who set these up are very entrepreneurial, but not so sophisticated and maybe not so familiar with international dealing, international law, and or contracts in any way. And so you can expect there to be some challenging activity to create an initial engagement that you feel comfortable with, and also to make that stick. And so there's kind of an unwritten rule in China, for example, that the contract that you sign is the beginning of the negotiation. And I think it to be true because I found that the business people have a changing market strategy or changing business strategy, and it's changing much faster than the pace with which we do in the Western world. Their opportunities are moving. So the deal that you strike may seem very appropriate to the business manager you're dealing with that day, but as little as 30 to 90 days later, they may have a different view of the market altogether and a different idea of what would be a reasonable or acceptable deal. I'd caution people to think about the communications taking more time. I think that it's kind of natural due to language difference and cultural differences. And I also found that, for example, in China, that a negotiation is thought to be accomplished over a long period of time. If you do it quickly, it obviously wasn't done well. And so spending 1, 2, 3 days going over 4 days, 5 days maybe, going over something that you'd think could have done an hour would be more normal for them to feel that they've actually done a good deal and been thorough in terms of achieving their result. The second point is about the complexity of the relationship or the manufacturing infrastructure. If you're going to be building products in a developing nation, the first thing that I've seen is that these partners are very, very eager and enthusiastic to get your business. And to a great degree, they may overlook the shortcomings and maybe not get into sufficient detail to know exactly what they can and cannot do on your operation. And because of that enthusiasm, you jump right into it yourself, and then you find out 30 days later or 6 months later that they didn't really have the competency or they hadn't thought it through. The cost basis isn't exactly what they thought. So you're constantly going back to that original negotiation. They have very little problem coming back to the agreement and saying, this isn't what I thought, and going back and redoing the deal. So when you think about your relationship, in these first two points that I'm bringing, I think you're going to have to accept the fact that this is going to be a changing environment and a learning environment on the part of your partner and also on your part. It's very difficult to just do the contract and expect it to stay that way for the next 12 or 18 months. The last point I want to talk about is intellectual property, and I think everyone here knows that in some of the developing areas of the world, in particular China, intellectual property is not held with the rigor that we do, certainly here in the U.S. and the U.K., the Western world. I would say number one is that they have an open environment in communication. I find the people to be much more open with their competitors and much more open as a technical community. So they tend to share information more freely than we do, and as a result, trying to maintain secrecy from the start is a difficult challenge. They experience much higher turnover in the developing regions. People are being opportunistic. They will work for a relatively short period of time and move on. So you have a constant flow of direct labor people and engineering people and management people turning over at a much higher rate. I've seen in China 50% per month in some operations. There is sometimes a sense of entitlement. In a developing world, I think the belief is that they've been held back for some different reasons, and you've been able to develop intellectual property and had some advances, and it is, as a developing nation, our right to have access to that information. And we should be able to use it freely. Just because we've been held back, we can have it. So it's not only a sense of shared information, but a sense of entitlement. What I found is the best thing to do is to try to, first of all, limit the critical intellectual property that you're sharing. A lot of companies do this. They'll hold back an ingredient or part of the operation that they think is the most critical piece. And if you can do that, you have the best chance of protecting your position. What we've done is sometimes we'll set up dual factories where you'd like to have it under one roof, but you might set up two operations, one that does half of the process, another one that does the other half. And what you do is you split the technology in pieces so that the rank-and-file engineering people won't be able to get access to the entire process and therefore go set up a competing operation against you. So you need to be cautious in the area of IP. I think we all see this great opportunity of working together with the wild and wonderful emerging space, but there's some risks there, principally in the area of IP, I think, and secondarily in terms of establishing fixed firm deals that will last for a long time.
Thanks very much, Dave. Venu?
Thank you. My name is Venu Raghavan. I'm the president and CEO of Encora, Inc. We are primarily focused on product development and software engineering in the ISV sector. Before I drill a little deeper into the best practices in software development, I'd like to just go on a little detour in terms of emerging segments. Today, we've heard a little bit about China and Brazil and Russia and India, but if you focus on India from a software development standpoint, India is an offshore destination, if you will, for IT services, but it offers much more than just a cost arbitrage. It demonstrated track record in terms of global delivery at low cost has enabled it to transition from low-cost application development and maintenance, if you will, to higher services like product engineering, co-product development, IT infrastructure management, related services. And the whole segment is kind of absolutely growing dramatically. Within that, if you go back and look at some of the best practices and learnings from some of the failures in the past, I like to basically categorize them in terms of best practice around three different sectors: organization alignment, project delivery alignment, and testing alignment. From an organization standpoint, being able to basically the long-term relationship and commitment to goals, alignment with company culture, governance structure, the way it is set up to manage programs, the way the contracts are set up, specifically in the product engineering space, I think they play a very critical role in terms of organizational alignment. From a project delivery standpoint, being able to manage a competent program management office, to manage the relationship, to manage the financials, to manage the performance of this vendor partner, again, is one of the best learnings there. Again, being able to freeze the specifications early on so that any changes to the functional requirement specification is managed through a very rigorous change management process is also something that needs to be considered as you consider looking at global distributed delivery. From a testing standpoint, making sure that the test strategy and the test plans are created much, much, much early on in the product development lifecycle. making sure that you do not bring in the test teams later on in the construction phase or during the construction phase. Typical mistakes that we have seen in the product development lifecycle, and I'm contrasting it to the traditional software development lifecycle, the typical mistakes you would notice is bringing the testing teams much later in the game, much later in the software development lifecycle. Again, testing includes things like unit testing, regression testing, performance testing, functional testing, integration testing, etc. So essentially, if you look at just testing as a segment within the product development lifecycle, that whole market is expected to grow from $300 million today to about $1 billion by 2007. If you look at, again, the product development space, that whole segment is expected to grow to about $8 to $11 billion from an outsourcing, offshoring standpoint, from a global distributed delivery standpoint by 2008. So we're looking at some dramatic growth here in the independent software vendor lifecycle in terms of embracing the offshoring, in terms of embracing outsourcing. And I like to believe that India is extremely well positioned to be able to move from traditional application development maintenance services to be able to go after co-product development, to be able to go after product design, product management, etc. And we will talk a little bit more in terms of the whole OPD, the outsourced product development space. But fundamentally, some of the best practices in this space can be broken along these three lines.
Thank you, Venu. Actually, let me use that as a jumping off point and talk a little bit about a couple of the innovations I think you guys have raised and you're a part of. Venu, you touched upon OPD. Let me give a quick layman's interpretation of what that is. What we're seeing is the next generation of software development is the handing over of specs and telling the Indian organization, typically an Indian organization, to come up with a whole product. And a lot of venture-backed companies in this area are looking to India to be a very important cost-saving delivery route. So a VC will deliver $10 million or $15 million to a software company and say, deliver me a product for that. And the only way that they can do that, or one of the likely ways that they will do that, is to utilize Indian costs to deliver it. This OPD, outsourced product development, is the taking over of that whole development process and moving it to India. How does that work? Has it been working? And does this finally mean that this is a step towards India actually producing shrink-wrapped software products?
Good question. I think the current OPD market is expected to be around $4.6 billion today from an India standpoint, and that is expected to grow to about $8 to $11 billion by 2008. So we are looking at some dramatic growth here. Secondly, historically, independent software companies have looked at smaller functions, slivers of functions that can be outsourced instead of the entire product being built and outsourced. Why are the ISPs, why are these independent software vendors looking at offshoring? I mean, clearly an increasing cost is one of the reasons why they're looking at potentially partnering. But also the whole process, the whole delivery process, and being able to reduce the time to market, to be able to launch multiple products concurrently as they go out and compete in the market space to win business. From an India standpoint, the whole transition from pure play application maintenance to product design to high-level architecture to being able to shrink wrap and take the whole delivery process, I think they've come a long way. But that entire sector is considered a sunrise industry today. And lots of venture capitalists are going behind it. Lots of IT companies are trying to transition. Again, this sector comes with its own sets of challenges. From an independent software vendor standpoint, they would like to outsource, but they want control. So again, IP and IP protection and security plays a very important role in terms of being able to look at offshoring. That does not apply to a traditional, if you will, software development lifecycle. Secondly, the entire process, there are lots of differences between an SDLC, software development lifecycle, versus a PDLC, which is a product definition of product development lifecycle. In the PDLC space, and if you look at high level, the differences, just the way the contracts are set up, the team structures and the governance model between these two cycles are very distinctly different. Thirdly, in terms of IP protection, in terms of making sure that you have visibility into the operations of the product delivery process. Because for an ISV, the core, the soul of their entire next generation product release is something that they're handing it over to a third party. So they want tremendous amount of visibility, tremendous amount of control in the way the product is conceptualized, product is engineered, product is sustained, etc. So that entire transformation from a vendor standpoint, from a partner standpoint, to be able to provide operational visibility, to be able to provide cultural transparency, to be able to provide ability to acquire the center tomorrow if they so desire, in terms of the whole BOT concept, being able to build and manage and run and eventually transfer equity to this independent software vendor. Very, very interesting space, both from a VC standpoint as well as from very boutique niche players who are trying to graduate to the next level to be able to play in the co-product development space.
Dave, you touched upon one of your innovations and how you've broken up the supply chain. Could you elaborate on that? I think a lot of the audience may not have understood the complexity that you've built in to protect your IP. From what I understand, and again, layman's perspective, you've actually isolated your IP in different places so that the dots cannot be easily connected by any one vendor. Is that essentially what you're doing?
Yeah, the issue of the protection of the IP, it just suggests in any way that the couple ways that IP gets shared or lost, and I speak in particular to China, but this does happen in other parts of the world that are developing or emerging. One is one in which the principal management team or the manager that you've gotten involved will take and set up a parallel operation doing the same activities and would share that with someone that he's friendly with or she's friendly with and duplicate that activity to create a market opportunity for themselves. A second one, which is and the one that's probably the most prevalent, is that the core technical team or some member of the core technical team will get full knowledge of the process end-to-end and then be setting up a separate operation on their own and thereby take the technology and go off and be very entrepreneurial. So what we did with two things, really, we said, given those two factors, we want the managing team to be local, culturally knowledgeable, and be able to move very quickly, to be empowered to do this, but also highly compensated in the success of our operation. So we made sure that we have owners that are part owners in our business and have a strong feeling about winning. And that, to me, is the most important ingredient in successful setup of an operation in an emerging market. Number two was to restrict the information available to the rank and file engineers. So what we did, and maybe it wasn't clear before, but we have a manufacturing operation that involves first the production of a core differentiated chemical ingredient. And that ingredient, although patented, has some significant, potentially significant impact in the area of batteries that we make. That ingredient we set up and made two factories. The first process is done in factory A. That material is shipped to factory B, and the second process or completing process is done there. It would be much more efficient to have the two under one roof, but we separated the two. Process step number one is done in one location, and in a completely different area, process step number two. What ends up happening is the engineering teams are separate, and neither team is familiar with the operations at the other facility. Therefore, the rank-and-file employee would have difficulty just taking the process and going off and setting up a parallel operation.
That's helpful. Thank you. I was on a panel not that long ago, and I was asked to convey some horror stories of my experiences as an investor in India. I thought I'd throw it out to you guys to share with the audience any challenges. Maybe we don't have to call them horror stories, but challenges that you've had to face and overcome in the lines of services and businesses you're in. Sean, do you want to, or Dave?
Well, one of the challenges that many of our clients have when they set up operations in India is the high turnover rate of staff, and I think someone else on the panel touched on that. I don't think it's quite as high as 50% a month, but it's high. I think that is essentially arising from two different things that have been done wrong. First, I think a lot of foreign companies try and import their style of management into their Indian subsidiary. And I think that doesn't always work. For example, having too open or too democratic a style of management can, in certain cultures, be interpreted as a sign of weakness and taken advantage of. So I think that's one step. Every single Indian operation which is successful that I've come across has had a strong general manager who understands what the parent company requires of him, but is left alone by the parent company to deliver it. Secondly, I think there is a big difference between the Indian culture and the European culture, and I say that really from my heart as someone who was brought up in India and then went to Europe and lived there a long time. I think in India we tend to value very much the learning experience. So when we go into a job, we are looking at what that job's got to offer us right now, how much training it's going to give us, what other opportunities are there within the company to get wider experience, what value would that wider experience be, and how would it fit into an overall development plan, a career development plan. Now, if the company fails to understand that and doesn't have a proper appraisal process, and doesn't really communicate with the employee what their plans are, say, over a 2-3 year term, and doesn't or does communicate the plans, but the plans aren't really attractive enough, then the employee is going to move. Mm-hmm. We know from our own operation in Mumbai, which is now about 55 people strong, that by implementing this, we've actually dramatically cut down our staff turnover rate. We have a very, very low turnover rate, maybe around about 5-6%. It's about double Europe, but it's very low by Indian standards. And I think those are, you know, whenever you're in a new country, you need to look at the cultures of that country, and you have to fit around the cultures. The cultures aren't going to fit around you.
David, I was just wondering, you had your hand up. Have you had your IP stolen? Have you had to deal with that, and then how have you handled it? And
Well, I had an example maybe 7 or 8 years ago of a product that we designed here in the Boston area, prototyped it, and then subcontracted it in China. We had hard tooling made up. It's a relatively simple electrical device that we were making and selling globally. This product was fully manufactured on a subcontract basis in China, including the consumer packaging that we used to put into retail shelves to sell to people who buy computer systems as a computer peripheral. You might go to a CompUSA and see this kind of product. And I was over in China, in Beijing, and I was going through some of the markets, and I saw something that was identical to ours, but China-ized. As Chinese language, the colors were the same. The brand had the similar logo, just a little different. All coloring, all graphics, and the outlets in this case were China-ized, but the tooling was ours. And they were being sold in retail quite effectively, and they looked very good. And so I went back to our subcontract manufacturer, and he ultimately, he had to actually set up the tool in a modified way, and was selling out to a partner who was making these things and selling them. And they didn't bother to try and disguise it in some way, which they certainly could have done. They were with every color, every character, everything was the same, except the words were actually in Chinese. So we were able to slow that down and to cut it off at that time. But it's quite common.
Just happened, Bob. You had some points you wanted to share.
Well, only about what Sean was saying a little bit earlier about the investment in people. If you don't do it, as big a country as China or India is, that word gets around immediately. So if we have a client, I was just talking to them the other day, it's one of the largest companies in the world, and our issue recruiting for them is that the community of executives understands that one of their greatest attributes, which is promoting internally, works against the nationals being hired and moved up into executive positions. So they've got something to overcome there. Where we would consider something of great value and worth advertising, in the in the home country in India, and in particular, this is where this was, it's working against them hiring top executives because they figure that the minute it gets to a promotional opportunity, there'll be an internal promotion by this corporation, and they'll hit a glass ceiling, if you will.
Bob, in America, when one goes out looking for executives, when you're looking to recruit, you know, in my mind, the two criteria are competence and integrity that you look for. Mm-hmm. Is that true in emerging markets as well? Does that lead to success?
Well, I think you're looking for competence and integrity, but what is happening, China, for an example, has a law, a regulation, that you might hire somebody for a few months and you get sort of a few months' opportunity to see whether they're to judge their competence. So if you have a friend or a relative that you feel can do the job, and there's no explicit, there isn't a real culture around a job description, there's not a culture, there specifically is not a culture around checking references on a person's capabilities. So no job description, no culture or mechanic of checking references, you're apt, and a legal regulation which allows you to try someone out. You're very apt to try someone out, and then once you try them out, there's a loyalty aspect to letting them go, particularly if there's some sort of a relationship, a familial or friendship relationship. So it's harder to part company later on. So in fact, competence is highly sought after, but it isn't sought after in the same way in China, right, as on the same time frame as it is here in the United States. And as David was saying, it's not an issue of integrity at all, right? It's an issue of trust. And in terms of working with the your operation and your executive team, your management team over there, legislating a change to that doesn't work. All right. So you've got to understand what that cultural mores is, have some patience with it, and work around it. All right.
Just one more HR-related question, because I think it's one of the most important things you can think about when you're looking at an emerging market or entering one. There's a number of NRIs, non-resident Indians here in the U.S. that. Many of which were born in India, speak the language, but have been working here, and are now planning to go back. Mm-hmm. What advice do you have for them, and what advice do you have for people looking at those hires for selecting them for assignments in those markets?
Well, what I would say is their timing is good, because there's a demand in emerging countries for people who have been trained, educated, have hands-on experience in the United States. So if you're thinking of going back, one of the proven routes might be to work through a search firm, an established search firm or headhunter. I'm not saying this from a self-serving standpoint. It wouldn't have to be Korn Ferry. There are enough other firms out there. But what I've learned is that one of the high requirements that we are saddled with filling executive positions overseas is that kind of an experience. And one of our hunting pools is developed countries of nationals who want to move back to their home country. So that certainly is happening.
Okay. It's a trend that's growing. With that, why don't we open it up to the audience, see if there's some questions, if you can take a mic.
Hi, my name is Sudhir Nunes, and I have a question for Dave Vu. I'd like to know what are, particularly in the battery industry, I'm aware that there are other battery manufacturers that are getting parts of their processes completed in China or other parts of the world. What are they doing to protect their intellectual property, and do you think that your strategy of splitting up your process may become a source of competitive weakness in the future?
Let me just repeat the question. I want to know what are the other companies doing to protect their intellectual property?
Specifically, with your strategy involves actually splitting up a process to isolate the engineers and minimize that possibility. What are the other companies doing in that regard? You mentioned that your strategy does lead to inefficiency. In other words, higher costs, I assume.
Yep.
Do you think is this a short-term strategy, or is this something that might become a hindrance to you in the future?
It's a very, very good question. So what are the other companies do? Well, in our particular world, and using the battery world as an example, the leaders in advanced battery technology were in the last 15 to 20 years in Japan. And the Japanese have kept a very closed market to a great degree over the majority of that time and kept their facilities off limits. And even customers buying hundreds of millions of batteries, for example, would only get access to half of the visibility of half of the process. So they really kept it pretty much under lock and key. The Chinese broke the market open in around 2000 using completely dead opposite methodologies for making product and really built around manual or semi-automatic manufacturing processes, much, much lower cost, and actually demonstrated that they could make reasonably good, not perfect, but reasonably good quality, and make a reasonably good profit, actually much better profit margins than had been experienced by the Japanese and, to the degree before that, American. The Chinese have not been developers of intellectual property by and large. What they were is some development of techniques or processes that were built around the skills that they've got, and that manual and semi-automatic method, and basically extremely low-cost approach. So neither of those two organizations had that. We, as a Western nation who have got tremendous creativity, our technology came from MIT. We've got a great team of people here in Boston in terms of being out-of-the-box thinkers and innovators, are really built around IP. We exist because we have a differentiated product. So how do we, and using this as an example for everyone else, how do you protect that when you don't really own the low-cost infrastructure that the Chinese do and you don't enjoy the manufacturing strength and basis that the Japanese have done over time? How do you compete? As a startup business, how do you go out and fight this when you've got this intellectual property? Because if you give that intellectual property up, your basis and reason for existing, that differentiation, the advantage you've got, disappears. So it becomes a very critical piece to us. So those companies don't have that requirement as much. Although what we've seen the Japanese doing recently is to take advantage of the low cost in China, they are now doing the core property processes in Japan, the basic coding operations and some of where the real intellectual property is. And then they're outsourcing into China some of the more commodity-type activity where there's a little bit less intellectual property. They really have a three-step process as well. They're buying materials from the lowest cost source. We, in this case, make some of our own materials. They do the key manufacturing processes in Japan, and then they outsource the third step into China. It adds some inventory and it adds some time in the process, which is detrimental, but the cost benefit has been proven to outweigh that. In time, I think, to answer your question finally, in time, we will be doing more consolidation into China, and I believe we will over time set up secondary operations outside of China to balance the manufacturing from a risk standpoint, mitigate potential political issues and the like. But I think the principle that I'm talking about for new businesses and businesses that are really dependent on IP is that you need to think through this problem, not punish your business with extraordinary costs, but don't assume that you're going to be able to protect your intellectual property in the courts, because you will not now or for the foreseeable future in China and in some difficulty in other areas as well.
Next question.
Thank you. Hi. I want to thank all of you for being here. First of all, my name is Tom Hamilton. I'm an MBA student here in Boston. And my question is, a lot of the case studies that we read talk about the low cost of doing business in some of these countries stemming around cheap labor. And I'm wondering, there's going to be a lot of other costs. There are things in China such as transportation expenses due to less developed infrastructure. I was wondering if any of you could touch on some of the hidden costs that might arise in doing business in some of these nations.
Well, some of the hidden costs I
one of our clients to staff. I mentioned the client that grew to 2,500 people in 18 months. One of the hidden costs is that in order to fuel that growth in staffing and manpower, they regularly travel 1,000 to 1,500 miles to recruit whole classes of high school graduating students and then bring them back to their facility and house them and so take care of all room and board, but they'll recruit a whole class of people, so they'll bring back hundreds from neighboring towns. So that's a bit of a hidden cost. You know, interestingly enough, another hidden cost is we're doing a search for a company now whose Asian operation, like David said, is managed, a significant Asian operation managed by a national, and they had gone out and hired a CFO here in the United States, experienced in multinational operations. And after about 9 months, it became very clear that there was a cultural mismatch. The CFO and the GM in Asia were not connecting. They didn't replace the GM in Asia. They replaced the CFO here in the United States. Right, and that's a small example of a major cost being incurred because they didn't drive that that relationship issue and test the cultural understanding and the ability to communicate on the front end. So essentially, now this time round, they're flying that general manager from China here to the United States to interview two finalists. And, you know, that's redoing $150,000 cost because of a lack of planning on the front end.
Thank you.
There's also a hidden cost. If you're planning to pull out, a lot of people don't look at the cost of getting out of a country when they get into it. And costs of getting out are not small. If you've incorporated, you've got local subsidiaries. It's certainly something that you should look at at the time you're planning to get in. What is the cost of getting out if it doesn't work out?
I'll add one comment on that hidden cost issue. What I found is that the leadership in most of the subcontract partners that we've worked with or talked to have a really good concept of quality on a tier one global basis, but the organizations get very weak very quickly. As you get into rank and file employees, you find a completely different mindset, and the lack of training and the depth of talent, especially at the growth rates they're growing at, ends up putting the onus or the responsibility of maintaining quality at the levels you expect on you. And so we've had to build an infrastructure, a team of supplier quality engineers and logistics management throughout Asia. The cost of doing that really wasn't as anticipated as we initially. Now, in time, I think it'll end up balancing out as the relationships become more mature. But in the early stages, the cost of travel associated with people flying from here, I went there 10 times last year, it's pretty significant early on, but I think in time it can be modified.
Thank you. Next question.
Okay. Yeah, several of you mentioned the major problem of turnover in the emerging countries, particularly interested in the turnover in the IT sector in India. And Sean mentioned some sort of a solution in terms of training of the workforce as an incentive. And what my question is, do you have experience with other strategies, whether they are financial or resting-type strategies that try to retain employees over longer periods of time that are attractive in terms of reducing that turnover? Because that's a problem for folks from here who are employing people there, or if you're contracting out, you find half the team is missing by the time you've gone down to halfway down the project. So the question is, are there other strategies that may be successful in extending the retention of employees?
That's probably retention at different levels for different, senior executives would have different retention issues than operating employees. But perhaps, Sean, do you want to
I wasn't being prescriptive in terms of what I was saying. What I was saying was just a couple of things that do work. That doesn't mean that there aren't other hot buttons that if you push won't work. But I'll tell you one thing that definitely I think exists in India. A lot of Indian employees, when they come for job interviews, want to work for quote-unquote big companies. So if you're a venture-backed company, a relatively young venture-backed company hiring in India, it can be sometimes a bit of a struggle to persuade them that they've actually got a better opportunity with you than going and working for Nortel or Intel or one of the big boys. I think in those circumstances, the kinds of incentives that you've just mentioned would come in useful. Absolutely.
So we had mentioned, a couple of David mentioned earlier that sharing some of the equity in the organization with the executive team is one retention strategy. Educating the team is another retention strategy. Transferring them to the corporate headquarters, training them, and then returning them is another retention strategy. And those things from the people with whom I spoke were more important than a pure cash retention strategy, because basically you're building some loyalty to the organization. Comments?
No, I agree with that. We found the equity a little bit difficult to communicate the in the middle of the organization. In our world, particularly in the Boston area, people in the middle engineering areas understand it quite well. But throughout Asia, I have found it to be of little regard, even though we know it to be important. But at the senior level, it's been very much appreciated. We had an issue where we have Chinese New Year, for example, in a subcontract factory that has had rampant turnover. Wages have been going up in the area of South China quite a bit. So at the lowest level, getting people, operators, trained and keeping them has been some difficulty lately. Actually, been in some cases some shortages of labor, believe it or not. And so we provided a two-part bonus at the Chinese New Year break. These people typically will go back home for a week or 10 days at some distance from where they are and may or may not come back. So we provided a bonus on the way out and the other half of the bonus when they got back.
And that worked.
And it really, okay. it did do a pretty good job. But, I mean, this is pretty rudimentary level thing.
Next question.
So, Vino. Question is about software licenses and outsourcing. So I've seen projects go out where you develop just small components, reusable components, and they put it back together over here. Algorithms tend to be patented, and you have licenses for those. So when they reuse those pieces, we are not aware of what components get used. We just put them together. Or even if you have them put them together, is there an issue with software licenses? And this could be to Dave as well. But
I think the answer is in two parts. One is understanding the risks of offshoring, outsourcing, if you will, generally, which includes things like operational risks, things like human resource risk, which our friends just touched upon, includes cultural risks, geopolitical risks, etc., purely from an offshoring perspective. And understanding and putting a risk mitigation strategy generally. But specifically with regards to patents, one of the things that we have seen in the independent software vendor space or the OPD space, the patents, the IP is owned by the end client. So while the components are individually built by the partner, by the development partner, they don't understand the big picture. What it means is they identify certain key functionality, give it to the development partner for them to build it, and roll it back in into the enterprise product. And the IP is retained here, basically. But one of the things they want to make sure, the IP protection still comes as an issue in this offshoring process, is to make sure that the India arm does not understand, does not take the whole big picture and then go and reproduce another product. So contractual alignment, making sure that they do not compete. One of the things, for example, our client has done in this particular case is when they signed up a pure end-to-end product development space, they signed an agreement that this offshore partner does not go and build similar products or similar components for the top five competing companies in their space. For example, this was a company in the enterprise asset management space. So the contract, the way it was structured, was the offshoring company will not be allowed, in some sense, contractually, to go and build or work for companies, the five competing companies in the enterprise asset management space, which competes in this space. So in some sense, making sure that the intellectual property is retained, making sure that the IP is still managed here in the U.S. where they're targeting and supplying to the clients, and making sure the components as they're built, they're not part of the big picture, but being able to get them and then consolidate them and integrate them in the U.S.
But that's not enough granularity, though, right? I mean, a component is still...
Can you elaborate? Yeah.
For example, I mean, you could, in the software domain, you could have, let's say I want a crawler. A crawler, in turn, could use certain algorithms across different projects. And I'm saying this because I'm coming from a community where it's mandatory to say, well, this is GPL, general license, public license, or right, or what have you. So there's a high chance probability that you reuse a lot of that without stating what the license is. So...
Well, you could do so much from, as I said, right, from making sure that this development partner doesn't have the ability to take the entire architecture. I mean, you could low-level components, classes, etc., potentially could be reused in terms of building similar products elsewhere. But as long as the high-level architecture, the high-level design, and the high-level class components are in some sense protected as part of this contractual relationship and obligation, the client here is able to protect their interest in some sense.
I think we're just about into lunch, so just one last question from the back, and we'll end the session.
Thanks. My question is again related to software development outsourcing. And with the OPD model, are you seeing an increased emphasis on domain expertise on your side? And if so, are you finding that locally or... I guess, how are you addressing that issue, if it is actually an issue?
Extremely good question. In fact, on two areas, this OPD is kind of struggling to take it to the next level. One is, if you look at OPD, there are two different streams. There's a professional services stream, there's a product development stream. From the PS standpoint, they want consultants who have the domain experience. They have consultants who bring in the business knowledge, being able to go and implement the product at larger enterprise, at larger sector space. So there is a shortage in some sense of domain guys when it comes to the professional services side. On the product development side, independent of the sector or the space or what we call the solution cluster, and solution cluster could include things like business intelligence products, could include things like enterprise asset management products, could include things like supply chain products. Independent of the solution clusters, from a technology standpoint, they're generally very neutral. So it could be hardcore Java platform, and then folks who understand being able to build a product or a project around the technology. So on the product dev side, when it comes to offshoring, which is where you leverage offshore, there is not so much a constraint in terms of requirement for a domain-specific knowledge. On the professional consulting side, on the professional services side, when you actually go and work alongside of an OPD client, alongside of an independent software vendor, in implementing the product at their client side, that is where they would like the partner to be able to bring some domain knowledge to the table. And there's a huge constraint. And one of the reasons why on the PS side, on the professional services side, ISVs are still struggling to, in some sense, partner strongly with resources or with teams in India, basically. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so how are you addressing, I mean, what's the, are you growing that domain expertise organically, internally, or, you know?
Again, a good question. What we are doing there is bringing in business analysts, bringing in folks who have worked in similar line but don't have the product knowledge. For example, someone who's, if you talk about supply chain, someone who's worked with i2, just as an example, Ariba Market Board, bring those consultants in, train them up in their lab. Most of these ISVs have a very rigorous training process. So we have kind of set up labs. From our perspective, we set up labs in Pittsburgh and Scottsdale. So we train consultants up
on the product, on the architecture, on the deployment challenges, and what does it take to implement a product in a complex enterprise environment. So those are the areas that you train them up and then put them through a quick eval process. So they have the domain knowledge. They worked with I2s of the world, but they don't understand the specific product knowledge. So we're trying to bridge the gap in some sense in hiring high-end domain guys and being able to leverage them and train them across the enterprise. Parallelly, basically train them up on the product-specific knowledge. It could be done in-house or done at client sites.
Thank you. With that, if you'll join me in a round of applause for our panelists. Thank you very much.